Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities in London. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. In this interview, I accompany Leo Hollis, writer, historian, and publisher, on a walk through the noisy streets of the City of London. We start just outside the Royal Exchange, walk along Cannon Street, passing the London Stone, up Watling Street to St Paul's Cathedral. Leo reveals an intriguing history, part myth, part folklore, part truth, about the streets of London.
Hello, this is Leo Hollis. We're standing here in front of the Royal Exchange on a beautiful sunny summer London morning. I am the author of a number of books about the history of London. The first one was actually a history of London through 12 walks. I've then published a similar guide to walking around Paris, but then I returned to London with my last book called The Phoenix, which is the story of how London was rebuilt after the Great Fire of 1666. Really, my passion for the city came out through hitting the streets rather than hitting the library. I felt that one gets a sort of sense of human scale that I wanted to explore, and particularly it gave me the idea for the idea of The Phoenix. Wandering through the city streets, particularly going from east to west, but also crossing the Thames, I soon found that reading the street names, looking at the street patterns, having diversions down alleyways, I found that the 17th century seemed to be the real nexus of the city's story, the place where something radical had changed. And this gave me the idea of writing about that iconic moment, the Great Fire.
Which came first? Was it the writing or the walking?
It was definitely the walking for a good many years. It seemed to me an absolutely essential way of finding out about what I would call home. I was born in London, and then when I was 10, I moved out. So there was always an urge when I came back after university, so in my early 20s, to really find out what this place was all about. It was an itch that I had to scratch, and it was the best way of doing it.
Did you set off with a sort of plan in mind that you were going to cover certain neighbourhoods?
It was nothing so organised. I mean, I think that was part of the joy of it, is that you start off really knowing very, very little. The kind of London that I did know was the West, and certainly the West End. But then I had moved to Whitechapel, and this was a place that absolutely sort of fascinated all my senses. So I was absolutely determined to work that out. Then one slowly, as one was connecting the East with the places that one knew in the West, you had to cross the city itself. And as a child, there was no reason for me to ever come here. So it was really discovering the place anew for the very first time.
Where we're walking now, which is in the City of London, it's probably the most walkable and most walked city, certainly in Britain, if not in Europe. You know, everyone walks here because it's cut through with lots of alleyways.
Absolutely. This was not something I knew until I actually did it. But certainly during the week, it is a hive of men in suits and builders and bike couriers. At the weekend, it's oddly eerie and empty, which really sort of tells you something about the place of work, that there is very few people who live here anymore.
Is this Cannon Street we're on? This is Cannon Street we're on, and we're passing a grill with a little plaque on top called the London Stone. So what's it about?
Well, the London Stone is more mythology than history. It is a tiny piece of encased, I think, oolite stone that has been here or near here in front of the Church of St. Swithin's, certainly from the medieval period, probably even earlier. They have discovered very close, just underneath Cannon Street Station, that there was the Governor's Palace, a Roman building, a sort of grand Roman building. And there is a theory that the London Stone was either a gatepost or a milestone from that period. But that's not why the London Stone is important. The London Stone is important because what people have in some ways given to it, the power that it has. They said for centuries, supposedly, that if the London Stone is ever removed outside the city walls, then the city will fall apart. It was here that the very first Lord Mayor within this district came from, and it was a tradition, certainly from the Anglo-Saxon period, that all laws were passed by touching a sword onto the stone. It was also here that Jack Cade, during the Peasants' Revolt, took possession of the London Stone and as a result took possession of London itself. What is, sadly, the truth is it's slightly more hokum than history. So why London Stone as one of the first foundational stones of London is important is it's where stone turns into stories, or where stories turn into stones. And this is really my, as it were, obsession with walking around London, that we have this physical space which we have to cut across, but we also have the stories that come out of these stones. And this is really the once upon a time.
Yeah, it's used more as a sort of place to strip your chewing gum than anything else these days, which is rather sad, isn't it? But...
Well, I think it's also honest. The most important stone is the forgotten one, and it's the least glamorous. It used to be just stuck in front of a JD Sports building, and then it was a Chinese bank, and completely forgotten. And they were planning to take it to the London Museum, but clearly they haven't done so yet.
Now we come across a sort of secret garden. Is this do you know anything of this? This looks actually... It looks old, but I think it's new, isn't it?
Well, this is St. Swithin's, which... ancient sort of Anglo-Saxon church was rebuilt by Christopher Wren, and Wren actually moved the London Stone in front of St. Swithin's in order to help the traffic flow. What we see here is the new Walbrook building, which I think is absolutely beautiful, exactly what in some ways London should grow into. It's really sitting on the riverbank of the Walbrook, which is covered over now, but was one of the main lost rivers of London, and had been throughout the sort of Victorian period, sort of office blocks. It was very badly bombed during the Second World War, and they quickly put up some pretty ugly buildings. So this replacement, I think, is absolutely modern, high-tech, ecological. It's certainly eco-sustaining. It's got this lovely dome, not that we can see at the moment, which in some ways sort of echoes domes further down the Thames.
What are your feelings on tall buildings and the protection of the view of St Paul's? Because you know, a couple of your books, and one in particular, you know, is very much honed in on St Paul's. So
there are two things. There's one is the question of preservation of historical buildings. That is a sort of never-ending debate about what should be saved and what shouldn't be saved. Ken Livingstone in 2005 and Boris Johnson in last year set out what I thought was an adequate, almost exciting proposal to preserve certain sight lines and views throughout the city. I think this is a stronger argument than an argument for preserving individual buildings, because it looks at the city as a whole.
Looking back historically, how much of what Hook and Wren laid out still persists today, and how much of it might be changed in the next 10 or 20 years with all the new building that's going on? Maybe put it this way, maybe I should say how much of it will change, you know, as we become even more increasingly virtual and mobile in terms of technologies.
I don't think one can change the human nature of people who want to meet up. I mean, effectively, because of sort of technology, we don't need the city at all. But the desire to have people together and to interact and be close by goes against the theory, as it were. New York after 2001, there were whole arguments about, you know, let's take the whole financial district out and sort of set it into nice little sort of converted barns in Connecticut. You could do exactly the same here, and we have seen in many ways the financial powers sort of slightly spreading out of the square mile into Canary Wharf and also into St. James's, where all the hedge funders tend to be. The spirit of Wren and Hook will always be there. Their most important buildings will be there. I think the street names will be there. And also, when I sort of say the spirit, I mean the questions that they asked
And they were the very first generation to ask them, were the first modern questions. And they're the same questions that we ask ourselves today. So just in terms of what a city is, the city might sort of change its fabric, but it hasn't changed its street grid that much, and neither has it changed its purpose.
We're standing on what is probably the best known bit of Roman London, Watling Street. At the end of Watling Street is St Paul's. I mean, you know, I've always known that. I've always known you come to Watling Street and you walk straight into St Paul's. Was that something that Wren considered when he was sort of planning the cathedral? Or?
And he was fascinated by the history of London. Particularly, he was fascinated when he was building Mary Le Bow, which is just down this alleyway, to discover a Roman road, and he saw this as a structural advantage, because he then put the tower on top of it, so he didn't have to build foundations. What Wren was a scientist, one of the very first scientists, and his motto is probably the same motto as the Royal Society, which is take no man's word for it. He was willing to tear up the history books and rewrite them. So he understood, and he was appreciative of classical and Renaissance architecture, but he had the strength and the will to rewrite anew. And so that's really what you get with St. Paul's, is St. Paul's has components from many different types of architectural history. So you get the dome from sort of Catholic Europe. There are saucer domes within the structure, which he learnt about from a study of Hagia Sophia in Istanbul. The sort of sides of the buildings are an allusion to Inigo Jones and the banqueting hall, and you sort of see the second story of the building hides what is in fact a sort of Gothic structure. So you get flying buttresses there as well. What he was willing to do is sort of say there isn't a single idea of beauty. That beauty can be manipulated, it is historically specific, it is also nationally specific. So when he had been in Paris and had seen great French Baroque architecture, and he had met Bernini, who was a great Italian Baroque architect, he came back to London with his plans for St. Paul's and said, I want something that is English. And that's really what you get with St. Paul's. It's taking something that was solid and firm and received from the ancients and turning it into plasticine and seeing whether you can do it yourself. The odd thing about, I think, the English Baroque and Hawksmoor and Wren is it was in some ways a bit of a dead end. Wren did not have many pupils. He didn't have a school, as it were. And so when Wren died in the 1720s, there were very few people to take that challenge on. Hawksmoor was perhaps the only one.
To me, which is incredible, I mentioned it before, but you know, we just step away from the main street and we're here in an area which is very low amount of traffic noise, and it's just different sort of setting. And I think that's something that you find when you're walking, is that you can be walking along main streets, but the advantage we have in London, and especially in the city, is there are lots of quiet routes we can follow, and each of those has layer upon layer of history, and we still get views of some fantastic buildings. And it's something that I feel is so different from anywhere else almost I've been.
I don't think it's unique, but I think it's uniquely London, obviously. There is something which is interestingly demotic about it. Wasn't rebuilt by a houseman, and there has never been a houseman sort of systematically recasting the city. It has had those layers, and so you know, the sort of strata poke up in sort of strange places. I mean, we're here and we've got St. Paul's in front of us, and then we've got Jean Nouvel's building, which, you know, it's impossible to sort of say too early on whether it's a great building or not, but it is a new layer of history, and people aren't afraid to be part of that narrative.
Okay, now I'm going to put you on the spot. I'm going to try and ask you, of all the different walks, and you've written walking routes and written books about taking certain walks, which walks would you recommend?
I mean, the first walk is I'm fascinated in the last sort of year or so with the rise of mobile computing and the way that sort of Google Maps or SatNav or... So my first walk is actually to turn everything off and just get lost, because I think very soon everything is going to become so accessible that actually finding your own route around and actually getting lost within the city will become an act of defiance. So just try and get lost is the first one, and find your own story. In terms of sort of structured walks within London, obviously the walking along the Thames is an important story and also a very pleasurable one. If one can go from, if one can make it from Tower Bridge to the Houses of Parliament. I think another fascinating one is trying to sort of uncover some of the squares of London. You know, the squares were invented in the 17th century. You know, the very first ones were Lincoln's Inn Field and sort of Covent Garden, and then you get St. James's. And that is really a way of looking at the sort of reinvention or the invention of the West End out of what was pasture land at that time. It's a very aristocratic city, but it's also very entrepreneurial. It was land owned by the sort of great families who wanted to make a quick buck out of building the city, and in some ways that is the template of how the city grew. So you can find something which is sort of deep in the West End like Leicester Square, but then you sort of find its great-great-grandchild in Notting Hill or in Richmond. That is one story of some of the DNA.
You're a parent, you have children at school, you're a publisher, you know, and yet you somehow find time to write and you have time to walk. So how do you fit it all in?
Well, walking is the first thing to suffer. I choose not to go by public transport when I can. I'm fairly familiar with the city now, so I know sort of how long things take. Walking will probably, you know, only take sort of 15 or 20 minutes longer than the tube and is undoubtedly more pleasant. My ambitions, I think, are getting longer and longer walk. I think that comes out of wanting to know something sort of the next strata down, as it were, to sort of get an even sort of deeper understanding. So, I mean, you know, sort of ideal is walking the whole of the Thames over, you know, 4 or 5 days. If I ever get, I'm allowed to do that, then, you know, that would be nice.
Do you take notes while you're walking along? Do you talk into a recorder like we're doing now? Or do you just go for a walk and note something down in your head and then come back to it?
Exactly. It's not that often anymore that I sort of read about something and then go and sort of see it, but that does occur.
Have you ever been tempted to write a history of walking in terms of people walking in London or in the country?
Oh, not within the country, but certainly within London. We have so many different types of walking, and walking has very much defined some of the shapes of London. I think that sort of London Bridge was built in the 13th century for pilgrims going to Canterbury. There's also the idea of Trafalgar Square as a public space, as a place of protest. Also, different types of walking, marching. You know, Karl Marx said that the revolution was going to occur not in Parliament, but in Hyde Park. And that's because while he was there, Hyde Park was used for a lot of military displays. So walking, it is a walking city. I think Richard Sennett is fascinating in The Fall of Public Man about walking, is that until about the sort of late 17th, early 18th century, a travelling tradesman could walk across the city and back within a day selling his wares. But at a certain point, with the rise of sort of technology, that was no longer possible. And that's why you get the start of sort of permanent shops, because you could no longer get to all your customers within a day.
That sounds fascinating. Oh, so where do you think the future of walking is in London?
I think walking is going to come back. We are much more interested in our bodies and in fitness, and I think that's one aspect of why people are going to walk. I do think that there is a considerable effort in creating public spaces. You know, Norman Foster's work at Trafalgar Square has been successful. I think when they pedestrianise Exhibition Road in South Cairn, that will create new communities. In the last, you know, sort of decade, walking along the South Bank has radically changed, you know, from the Tate to the Hayward. I mean, that's now packed. That has to be celebrated. Also, you know, from St. Paul's across the river to the Tate. So I do think that we are losing our fear of public spaces. We're no longer crossing them as if we're late for a train, in the words of sort of Oscar Wilde. We are enjoying London again. And I think that is due as much to sort of government as it is to people's changing sort of attitudes, that the government understand that we need investment in public spaces. And undoubtedly it'll be the first thing that gets lost in the new budget.
but I think it's absolutely essential.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities in London. In this episode, you've heard from Leo Hollis. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the talkingwalking.net website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.